In this segment, we're going to talk about Greek and Roman women. We've just talked about Jewish women before this, now Greek and Roman, and then in the next one, we're going to put it all together. So, here are some points about what we know about Greek and Roman women. And there have been, there has been a lot of work on this for now about 30 years. And once the interest in women got stirred up with biblical scholars and scholars of ancient Rome. So we refer to Greco-Roman, the Greco-Roman period. And I know a Greek woman, she's a tourist guide, who says, there is no such thing as Greco-Roman. There are Greeks and there are Romans. And she's got a point. And yet, at the same time, by the time of the New Testament, by the time the New Testament writers come on the scene, there has been a melding of cultures. If you know anything about the ancient Greek culture, traditions, you know, what we call the classics, and the time of the great Greek city-states of Athens and Sparta and the others, and how that culture evolved into what we call Hellenistic culture of the 3rd, 2nd centuries BC, and then into the time of Roman dominance in the whole of the Mediterranean rim, the Mediterranean area, there is a melding of cultures, and they take both the best and the worst of Greek culture and into Roman culture. And to give an example of that, the elites, elite Romans, when they got the best education, it was not only the Latin literary tradition, but the Greek. And some of the best of Roman literature at the time is written in Greek. The Emperor Marcus Aurelius, in the middle of the 2nd century, writes his memoirs in Greek. And it's very literary Greek, you know. On the streets in the city of Rome in the 1st and 2nd centuries, Greek was still the predominant language. And people who were from Italy and Rome spoke Latin as their first language, but there was enormous migration. And migration is one of the patterns that we'll be talking about, too. If what's going on today with the upheavals of people all over the world because of natural disasters, but also because of war, this kind of upset that's happening now was also happening just before the New Testament era in the Roman world. And then the economic prosperity, the economic boom that happened once there was peace, also encouraged a lot of migration. And we know, for example, of a Christian community in Gaul, present-day France, that underwent persecution. That's how we know about it. But they were from Asia Minor. They were from Turkey. So there are examples like that that we know of, and massive migration into the city of Rome. And the common language on the street was Greek. It's something, I could say something about Greek here, the Greek language at this period. English today is becoming the universal language. It's to the detriment of native English speakers who don't have to learn another language. But it's the language that everybody wants to learn. It's the language of business. Mass communication, etc. Well, Greek was that language then, not Latin. Official documents and official monuments were in Latin, but often with a Greek translation as well, so that other people could read it. And so Greek is the common language, and a rather simple Greek. We refer to Koine Greek, which means common, ordinary. It's the Greek in which the New Testament is written, and it's pretty much the Greek that's spoken on the streets. So we have that use of the Greek language. So it's no surprise that the New Testament is written entirely in Greek, and other post-biblical, post-New Testament, early Christian literature until the late second century. The first Latin Christian literature is from the late second century. Everything else before that is Greek. So if you want to understand the world of early Christianity, learn Greek. So cultural differences between Greeks and Romans. One of them that has to do with women that is often pointed out by Roman writers. So here we come with the cultural bias toward Greeks, and that the Greeks secluded their women. Women were supposed to stay at home, not go out into public. Well, that's nonsense. I mean, women were out in public. But we're talking about a cultural ideal of the elites, of the upper classes. And that women in the upper classes should not feel shut in by this, but rather they have the privilege of not having to go out. You know, the Jewish writer Philo, from the first century in Alexandria, echoes this by saying that married women should be able to go as far as the front door. Young unmarried women, not even to the front door. You know. So this is obviously an unrealizable ideal, but it's echoing an ideal of Greek. He's Jewish, but it's Greek culture. Elite males. Again, we don't know what the women thought about this, you see. So we don't have the women's voices. So Roman writers, a couple of them, will say, well, we don't do it the way the Greeks do, which is to keep their women inside. By contrast, our wives go with us to dinner parties out. So you have that perception of cultural difference. Okay? And of course, the Greek world, for a Roman, the Greek world is the East. It's from Greece east into the other Mediterranean lands to the east. And there's something there, and we'll talk about this when we're talking about the role of deaconesses too, about this idea of privacy for women, private part of the house, that men should not go visit women. And all of this, of course, continues today in echoes, particularly in Islamic societies, which are also come from that part of the world. So there is something about Eastern cultural customs wanting women to be protected, private, secluded, and in the West, not so much. And this is already echoed by Roman writers who are aware of this question. Now, a second point here is legislation versus real procedures. And here, I'm going to introduce this Roman word, potestas. It's a legal term. It means power. But it's a legal term for the authority. And we're going to be talking now about how Roman families function, because the families of the New Testament are living in the Roman world. It is the power of the male head of the household over everyone in the household. And theoretically, it is a power of life and death. Theoretically, the male head of the household, the pater familias, the title, has the authority to execute, after due process, to execute anyone who severely violates the norms of the family, the norms of the, of society. The obvious example of that would be adultery of women. Because adultery in this world is understood as the sexual relationship of a man with a woman who is not his wife, okay, but who belongs to another man, who is married to another man. So it's adultery is a question of the violation of the rights of a husband over his wife. So an obvious example would be adultery, murder, the sort of the big sins. So I say this is a theoretical power. There were some almost mythical stories about men exercising this power, but in fact, in reality, by the time we're coming into the time of Imperial Rome, which is the time of the New Testament, there are no attested examples of this actually happening, the life and death power. However, again, theoretically, the male head of household owns all the property of the family, including of his adult sons. So as long as the father is alive, he is the one who theoretically has the control and can act on it if he wants. In practice, that rarely happened. Okay. So, but this question of potestas is an important one. Now, when we talk about property ownership and citizenship and things like that, with property ownership, as I said, the as long as father is alive, he's got the legal authority and the legal ownership. And so when father dies, his sons, then his adult sons, acquire their own potestas over their own families. And so, as some Roman historians of Roman families say, probably people weren't terribly sorry when father died, because then they get the legal control. The males do. Now, what about women? Women certainly could inherit property. They were supposed to have male control. A tutor is the title of a man who would have authority over their property, whose permission they would need to buy and sell property, which they did on their own, but supposedly with this male authority. There were ways in which you could get out of that. And one of them was by producing a certain number of children, 3 and 4 children who survived to the age of 1. A woman would be rewarded for that. Notice that. They're worried about population in the upper classes. So they reward women for having children. So then you would be free of this, and you could do it on your own. So basically what it meant was that that control was, again, theoretical, and it wasn't terribly exercised. So women had property ownership. They did not have potestas. They did not have that kind of authority, but they did have legal property ownership and the ability to use it. Citizenship, women were also citizens in Rome, for Roman citizenship. And this is different from Greek, because as far as we know, Greek women did not have citizenship in their city-states, but Roman women did. If they were qualified and their family was qualified for Roman citizenship, the women were citizens also. The difference being, they did not have the vote. There were elections in most Roman cities for the city magistrates, the people who ran the city, and every male Roman citizen was entitled to vote. You had plenty of people living in these cities who were not citizens, not Roman citizens. Just because you were born in a place did not qualify you for citizenship. You had to have to come from the right family or do the right things to acquire citizenship. We'll talk about that a bit later. About marriage and divorce, we're going to talk about marriage again a little bit later, but here let's just say that that most women were married at a rather early age. The higher the social status, the earlier the age, because marriages were political opportunities for families. And so marriage was something that, in most cases, at least for first marriage, closer to what we would call an arranged marriage. Divorce was common in any of these cultures, Jewish, Greek, Roman. Divorce was commonly practiced, and that's why it was so unusual to have this tradition from Jesus against divorce. In terms of women's religion, in Roman religion there were particular devotions, particular cults that were only for women. The women participated certainly in civic religion. We distinguish here between civic religion and private religion. Civic religion is the worship of the gods of the empire and the gods of the city. Every city had its own patron gods as well. Private religion is perhaps what we're more concerned with, because Christianity was a private religion, but we'll talk about that more later. But in terms of civic religion, there were certain devotions that were only for women. One was the celebration of the Matronalia, March 1st. And so Roman matrons, a matron was a Roman citizen in a legal Roman marriage. That's a matron, a matrona. So, for instance, there was the celebration of the Matronalia, or of Mater Matuta, and one of the interesting things about the celebration of Mater Matuta is that the only women who qualified were matrons, Roman matrons, who were in a first marriage, not having been divorced. So there were these little segments of Roman society, women's society, in which women worshiped together, in which they had their own kind of celebrations, their own kind of companionship with each other. So these are some of the things that we could say about Greek and Roman women.